Hi everyone, welcome back to What About Us, Cultural Awareness and Clinical Psychology. I am Afsana. So in this episode, we're so fortunate because we've got two amazing guests, Dr. Ramona Farooq and Imma Ibu, who are both from the Clinical Psychology Doctorate Programme at Newcastle University. So Ramona is a Principal Clinical Psychologist and the Academic Director of the programme, and Imma is a third year Trainee Clinical Psychologist. So in this episode, they talk about the experiences of children and young people from racially minoritized backgrounds in secure settings and within the criminal justice system. And what they do is they begin to talk about things such as adultification bias within these settings, which include factors such as racial trauma, institutional racism, and social inequalities. And they make some great suggestions for culturally sensitive and culturally responsive services. So let's have a listen to what they had to say.
Hello, thank you very much for joining me. So today I am joined by two amazing guests. So we have Ramona Farooq and we have Imma Ibu. So I'm gonna kind of pass it over to you both to kind of introduce yourselves. So maybe we should start with Ramona, if that's okay. And then if you just let me know who you are, where you're from, and why you're here today, and then we can pass on the baton.
Thanks so much, Afsana. It's great to be I'm here with you, and I've heard so much about your podcast, so it feels like a real privilege to be here today. So like you said, I'm Ramona Farooq. I'm a principal clinical psychologist and clinical lead in the NHS. I specialise in working with children, young people and families who have been subject to child exploitation, modern day slavery, trafficking and human rights violations. I've spent many years working in secure establishments, but also with the criminal justice services as well, and I've worked with refugees and asylum seekers, but in particular I think one of my keen interests is working with children and young people from a racially minoritized background and developing, I guess, culturally sensitive and responsive services for these communities. And alongside that clinical role, I'm also academic director on the Newcastle University Clinical Psychology Doctorate, so I'm involved in the teaching and training of clinical psychologists, but also one of my keen passions is decolonizing the curriculum. So I've been doing a lot of work now around that. So that's a little bit about me, and I'll pass on to Imma.
Hi, Afsana and Ramona. Thank you both for inviting me to come to the podcast today. So I'm Imma Ibu, and I'm a third year trainee clinical psychologist, soon to qualify in about a month's time. And my experiences kind of lie in kind of high secure environments. So I've worked in prisons, psychiatric hospitals, and also secure environments with children. I'm really interested in increasing the diversity of clinical psychology, really interested in working with people who have experienced different forms of trauma and complex trauma, and really, really interested in helping to develop and maintain culturally responsive and culturally sensitive mental health services for individuals from all backgrounds, but especially racially minoritized ones.
Amazing. I mean, both of you, I mean, what you're doing, it sounds absolutely incredible. And why I'm really excited about today's podcast is because we've not had this topic actually spoken about in our previous episodes. So I'm really looking forward to this because I don't have much knowledge around the subject area. So I'm really going to be learning from both of you. So I'm going to kind of like pass it on again. And in terms of, if you just let me know a little bit about, first of all, how you got into this role. So what was your interest in terms of working with children from minorities, you know, communities, and how did that all start? So Ramona, if I can ask you, if that's okay.
Well, that's fine. And I think that's a really interesting question, Afsana, and one that I get asked quite a lot about. Why am I interested in working with children and young people that present with high risk, high harm and high vulnerability in some of the most complex settings like secure establishments and the criminal justice service? And I say it's because it's in these settings where it's really important that we offer ethical practice and treatment, and we take a human rights-based perspective when working with children who are detained, who have their liberties removed, and who are dependent on us as professionals to do the right thing for them. But I guess my interest in working in the criminal justice services, but also in secure establishments came about because, you know, over the past 10 years of SANA, you know, the youth justice policy has been reviewed and shifted, which has resulted, I guess, in like a remarkable decline in the number of children and young people that are entering the youth justice systems. However, and this is a big, however, one of the biggest things is that despite there being a decline over the past 10 years in children and young people coming into the youth justice system, we haven't seen a similar decline for children and young people from a racially minoritized background. And that's really fascinating. And the Youth Justice Board in 2018, it reported that there had actually been an increase in the proportion of racially minoritized children and young people in these settings from 27% in 2007 to 45% in 2017. So when you think about the most dominant narrative is that children and young people, or kind of individuals in general from a racially minoritized background, are accessing services or find services inaccessible. However, if you look at the sharp end of services, so tier four, secure establishments, criminal justice services, 45% of those children are from a racially minoritized background. And I find that extremely concerning and something that we need to be thinking about and exploring. And that similar trend of an increase in admission into these settings and detention, you will see in inpatient settings, you'll see in adolescent forensic mental health services. And myself and my colleagues did a recent research looking at the ethnicity of children and young people admitted into the Children and Young People Secure Estate. And we found a similar shocking trend. So for example, if you were Black, you were 3.9 times more likely to be admitted than your white counterparts. And if you were from a mixed or dual heritage background, you were like 6 times more likely to be admitted in these settings. And I guess that's what's kind of drawn me to these things, to really think about what is causing this differential and disproportionate nature of the kind of ethnicity of kind of young people that are kind of in these settings, and really wanting to kind of address that and do something about that. And I'm not sure if that's similar or different for Emma.
I think for me, I've always been interested in working with people just in a trauma-informed way. And coming from a psychiatric hospital I used to work in, which covered the area of Slough, and also working in a men's prison in London, I did see the ethnic disparities in terms of the amounts and rates of people who are admitted to these settings, but also in terms of the difference in treatment and support that they received. And I felt like it was just a very clear example of racism and white supremacy, but also with these settings, there's a lot of physical restraint used, there's a lot of really controlling and coercive practices that we use in these settings in order to manage the risk. And I saw that the amount of harm that it was having on these individuals, and I just found it really quite concerning. And so I think I just wanted to continue to work in these services and see how psychology, clinical psychology in particular, could try and maybe start to address some of these issues. And so that's why I found myself kind of working in these secure settings. And Romana's right in that the disparities are quite stark and actually quite concerning. So not only are children and young people from racially minoritized background and also adults overrepresented in these settings, we find that in these settings, they're more likely to receive physical restraint. They're more likely to make complaints about being treated in a disrespectful or punitive manner. They're less likely to be convicted of a crime. So even though they're held in custody, say for remand, those convictions are less likely to be held up in a court of law. And so we know that throughout the justice system, from stop and search all the way through to conviction and then sentencing, there are these massive disparities. And these are really well evidenced over many, many years. And I find that sometimes fields of different professionals don't necessarily address these issues. They know that they're there, they might talk about them, and then it kind of ends there.
That's really interesting. So I guess what kind of struck me a little bit is some of the words you use, like white supremacy and things like, you know, the control and all of that kind of stuff. And I guess what I want to ask and open this up to anyone who wants to answer it is, so I think Romana, you touched on a bit about the kind of prevalence of it prior to them actually getting into, or whilst they're getting into these services. And then Emma, you kind of talk about, you know, what happens whilst they're there. So do you find a link between what's happening outside of, you know, the services that they're detained under, and then what's happening within that? So like, do you feel that it's almost kind of mirroring effect between the pre and post, or however you want to frame it? So I guess the kind of question I'm asking is that, what are some of the incidences that are happening, or what are some of the reasons why these young people are, you know, being detained in these particular services?
That's a really good question. I really actually like that question. I think, as Romana will probably say, nothing occurs within a vacuum. So although we like to think of services as being held up to a certain standard and managed in a certain way, we still find that individuals working within these services have views that might mirror those of the dominant society or the government, which we know is acting in a really punitive way towards people from racial minoritized backgrounds, towards people who maybe come here seeking safety. One thing that we've spoken about quite a lot is adultification bias, which is something that we see the young people being subject to. An adultification bias is essentially a process through which children and young people from racially minoritized backgrounds are perceived to be older than their white counterparts or their peers. They're seen as more adult-like throughout all different stages of development. And that means they're more likely to be perceived as older, more mature, more sexually aware, less vulnerable, less innocent, more intimidating, all those different things. And studies have shown that this is seen in Black girls as young as 5 years old. And so when you're working with children who are age five, who are already being adultified and treated as if they're age seven, age 10, more aware, more intimidating, more all these different things, of course you're going to then see a difference in treatment and a difference in the way in which professionals and also individuals working within these systems react to them and respond to them.
I was just going to add to that as well, because I think Emma's spoken about adultification, and I think that's really very prevalent in secure establishments and the youth justice services, and it's well documented as well that that's the process that's often happening that leads to young people from a racial minority background being more likely to be detained, restrained and secluded in these establishments. I guess for me, it's also kind of interesting to kind of think about the fact that there has been a decline in children and young people coming into youth justice services, but that decline is only for white children and young people. So they have access to early intervention and they are more likely to be diverted away from the criminal justice services. That's not the case for children and young people from a racially minoritized background. When they come into contact with services, it's normally at the time of crisis. So they'll come into inpatient services and detained under the Mental Health Act, or they'll come into contact with the police. Services are not picking the needs of these children and young people up early enough, actually. So there's no kind of early intervention and there's no diversion. And I think, as Emma was talking about adultification kind of in these settings, you know, we know that social inequalities, systemic racism, institutional racism exists in society. We can't deny that. And I think anyone denying that would be quite an interesting debate to have. But if you think that exists in society, when you come into microsystems like secure establishments or inpatient settings, those dynamics around discrimination and racism are amplified. They're very much like kind of Emma was saying, they're very much prevalent. These can become quite pernicious systems, and it's really important for individuals working in these settings to have an anti-racist perspective, to be aware of how racial dynamics or systemic racism might get played out within these settings, and be aware of processes like adultification. And I guess that kind of links into the importance of having an inclusive and diverse workforce. The issue that we have in secure establishments is that the workforce isn't diverse and doesn't represent the children and young people in these settings. Hence, they are less likely to pick up on issues around race, ethnicity, racism, power, adultification. And I think that's the role of clinical psychologists working in these settings, especially those that are offering leadership, to be acutely aware of these processes and to be brave enough to name them, acknowledge them, and interrogate them as well.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with what you're saying then. I guess, again, you know, a lot of this information that you're giving me, you know, it's quite hard to take in because, you know, I think you're so used to hearing about the adult sector, and you hear a lot of this information being talked about within that particular realm, but to hear that it transpires also within the young people, children, young people, is quite alarming, especially for someone. And I must admit, I'm quite ignorant to the child sector because I've not really done much research within that arena. But I guess what I want to ask is, through the work that you've both been doing, what kind of things have you picked up on? I mean, do you, obviously, when you're going into these services, do you kind of see where the gaps are? And do you kind of, I know, Romana, you've touched a bit about on a, you know, anti-racist, you know, teaching and all of that kind of stuff, you know. So what are the gaps or what's missing within those services that you've kind of come across and thought, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't look right, or this can be improved, for example?
I guess, that's a really interesting question. I guess my counter question to that would be, are these services and systems ready to think about what gaps they have? What's the system and readiness to really interrogate itself and say, actually, are we meeting the needs of these children and young people, and what more can we do? Because as an individual from a racially minoritized background myself and offering leadership and within these settings, I guess what I found is that there's a real resistance to be able to think about what are the gaps, and are we meeting the needs of children and young people from a racially minoritized background? There's a real sensitivity kind of in these settings around mentioning issues around race, ethnicity, culture, even religion. I guess I cited kind of earlier that, you know, children and young people from a racially minoritized background were 45% represented in the criminal justice system, but there's issues around kind of intersectionality as well. There's a lot of research done that actually religion kind of also plays into some of these dynamics. So children and young people who might can identify as Muslim are more likely to be subject to discrimination within the criminal justice system and these services. So is there a willingness in these settings to think about, you know, perhaps where those gaps are and where we might be causing harm to children and young people?
Yes, I just want to just touch on that. So, you know, you talk about this resistance. What do you think the fear is? Do you believe that there's a fear around this, or is it just being, or is it ignorance? What do you think it is?
I guess it'll be interesting to hear kind of Emma's perspective kind of on this as well. I'll kind of offer some of my own and then pass over to kind of Emma to share some of her own. I think the resistance is similar to when you try to kind of implement anti-racist practice across any kind of system and service. There's this fear of being exposed. There's this fear of being seen as perhaps racist. And this kind of unwillingness to think about whiteness and white privilege and white supremacy and how that might be being played out within that system, and how we are all kind of accountable for that. But I also wonder whether it's a strong feeling of shame that people want to rid themselves of, so they push back kind of against it. But I'd be interested to hear what Emma thinks as well.
I'd agree with everything Romana said. I do think there's something about not wanting to be perceived as racist, even when people are engaging in behavior or expressing views that, in my view, would absolutely 100% be racist. And it's hard to know sometimes whether it is just ignorance or whether it is more of a, like a willful ignorance. And as well, I think because there are such massive and stark power imbalances within these settings, there's something about, I guess, the power that people hold to not think about these issues or to not address these issues. in terms of your earlier question around the kinds of things that we see, I think we do just see a lot of dehumanizing and very adult-like treatment of the young people. All these people are some of the most vulnerable in society because they are young people who have been deprived of their liberty. And we find that with children and young people from a racially minoritized background, the treatment can be increasingly punitive. And the way in which sometimes the staff or the systems talk about these children and their behavior in comparison to their white peers who express the same behavior would be very, very different. We might hear narratives such as, oh, he's just a lad, oh, he's just a cheeky chap, when they're talking about maybe a child from a white background engaging in behavior that we might think is concerning. But when we see child from racially minoritized background engaging in the exact same behavior, it starts to become a question and conversation about risk and punitive measures and maybe attributing more responsibility to them in terms of expressing that they know what the person is doing and why they're doing it. And as well for us as staff working there who are from a racially minoritized background, there is a lot of experiences of things like microaggressions as well.
Thank you. I'm wondering, so both of you again are from minoritized communities. Being someone myself as well, I'm from an ethnic minority community. How does that feel when you're in those settings? Taking on these leadership roles, you're going into these settings, you're doing your research within that. How has that shaped your research, or how has that shaped your thought processes, or how you perceive what's happening out there? I don't know if that's I don't know if you can answer that or not, but I'd be quite interested to know if that has made any impact on that.
I was going to say, actually, I think it's so valuable having inclusive and diverse leadership in these settings, because you're able to recognize these dynamics. You're able to name them and be able to respectfully challenge individuals, whether that's in clinical meetings, whether that's in formulations, in training, in any care meeting, because you're, as someone from a minoritized background, you are acutely aware of these issues. So hence, when working with a child from a racially minoritized background, you're able to consider aspects of their identity that might be important for their care and treatment. But I'm going to go back to my other question about, are these systems ready to think about the gaps and whiteness and power and privilege and racism? I think I've got another question, which is, are these systems ready for diverse and inclusive leadership as well? And I've previously written about my experiences as a woman of colour offering leadership and some of the difficult and challenging experiences that we have, which include, I think, Emma mentioned, being subject to microaggressions, or people finding it very difficult to take orders from us or advise, I think most things being attributed to, well, they've got a chip on their shoulder. That's why they keep talking about race. And I think it's really important for us to interrogate what are the experiences of individuals from a racially minoritized background, trying to shift and change the culture in these settings, and really exploring their lived experience in relation to that. Because if children and young people can be subject to discrimination in these settings, so can we as individuals trying to offer leadership. But I wonder if Emma's got any other additions.
I would say that these experiences have definitely shaped some of the research that we've chosen to do in these settings and conduct in these settings. I think it's also meant that when we're doing our clinical work, we're a lot more aware of how this might be impacting on children and young people who are already struggling with quite a lot, and also how this then impacts on staff systems, not just staff from racially minoritized background, but we've also experienced and been witness to micro and macro aggressions towards staff from all kinds of different marginalized backgrounds, such as on the basis of disability or sexuality. And so I think it's definitely changed the work that we do, but it also means that as a clinician or as an individual, these places can be sometimes quite tense and quite difficult to work in. And sometimes, especially at least for me as a trainee, it sometimes feels like you're really struggling to find your feet and even struggling to breathe at times within these settings, because not only are they so physically restrictive, and I think everyone struggles in these environments to a certain degree, when you add all these other intersecting parts and aspects of your identity, it just does become such a difficult place to navigate.
Thank you. I want to just come back to Emma then on this, if you don't mind. So I guess what I want to kind of find out is what's different in the sense, I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, there's an age difference between adults and children, but if we're talking about some of these experiences that children are facing in terms of these services, what might the impact be different from what maybe the adult population might experience? Or how could services, or, you know, those who are professionals working within this environment, cater for children differently to what you might expect maybe in an adult population, or is it the same?
I think one of the main things is around understanding and thinking about the developmental stages of the children when tailoring interventions and when designing the environment. In some ways, the environment tries to be very child-friendly with bright colours and, you know, fun games and access to things like PS5s and different kinds of child-friendly activities. But at the end of the day, it's still very, very restrictive because everything's, you know, nailed down to the wall. And there's a lot of different kinds of risk management procedures, which mean that it's a very difficult place for a child to be. And I think for a lot of professionals, when they've been working in this environment or some environments for a long time, it just starts to become part of what we do. And there's a lack of reflection on how this might be impacting on this child when you think about their age, not only biologically, but developmentally. But I'm sure Romana has some more comments to add to that.
Yes, just thinking about children and young people, I think one of the focus needs to be on power and voice. Children and young people might not feel like they have a voice kind of in these settings, and sometimes they don't, actually, because the decisions are often made for them in their best interests. But also like about how the lack of power that children and young people will have within these settings. And on top of that, if you're thinking about experiences of children from a racially minoritized background, aspects of their kind of identity is really important. And I guess in particular, when thinking about children and young people from a racially minoritized background, when they come into these settings, they've experienced a lot of racial trauma. And what they need is systems and services that are sensitive and responsive to that and racial and trauma. And I guess from the children and young people that we've often worked with, representation in these settings really matters to them. They've often said, you know, there's no one in here that looks like me. And how alienating and isolating that must be for a child who's deprived of their liberty, not being able to see people that look like them around them. So I guess when you're thinking about how to work with children and young people from a racially minoritized background, how can services not re-traumatize them is so important, I guess, to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I want to kind of then move on to the intervention side of it. So you talked about how interventions tend to work for those who are from children from a white background. So how does that differ? Or is it, you know, what can services do to be, you know, more culturally sensitive? I think, Romana, you kind of used that word earlier on in the interview. So what's been done now, and like what can be done to improve? I guess that's my question to whoever wants to answer this.
I guess there's a lot that we still need to do. There's a long way that we need to go when thinking about the treatment and the interventions that we offer children and young people from a racially minoritized background. We know that the interventions that are currently out there are normed on a particular group of children and young people, majority white. And they don't always work for children and young people from a racially minoritized background. We need more interventions that consider, acknowledge, and work with racial trauma and the fact that these systems re-traumatize children and young people from a racially minoritized background. We also need interventions that, I kind of used the word culturally sensitive kind of earlier. I often feel like services have kind of appropriated that word and kind of made it into something that kind of fits for them. But it was obviously something that was developed by individuals from marginalized communities themselves. But when we're talking about cultural sensitive, we're talking about cultural humility. We're talking about cultural curiosity. We're not expecting people to be experts on different difference and diversity in terms of race, ethnicity and culture, but really being humble and showing humility. And I guess like one of the things that we did within some of the settings that we worked in was around incorporating aspects of the social graces into the interventions that we did. So we would ask young people, you know, is there any part of your identity that's important for us to think about and consider during your care and treatment? And children and young people could decide to say, no, actually, there's nothing that here that's kind of important. But also, the message that it communicated to that child, even if initially they said no, was that it's okay to talk about my identity here, even if they didn't feel ready that first time, and to keep revisiting it. And I guess in terms of kind of interventions also, I think we as clinicians need to learn to be vulnerable as well. We need to interrogate ourselves and our identities and engage in self-reflexivity about why we are drawn to particular interventions as well.
I'll just add to that. I think there's definitely space for more familial or systemic interventions where more aspects of people's different intersecting family groups are involved. A lot of the trauma that we see with children and young people is collective, but a lot of the interventions that are offered are individual, and they don't necessarily address a lot of the issues that are contributing to what the young people are struggling with.
Thank you. Right, I'm conscious of time as well, because I know you need to be shooting off soon. So I think my last question I'm going to ask is, so I'm going to ask both of you in a different way. So Emma, I know you're in your final year of your doctoral program. So one of the questions that we ask all our guests is, what kind of advice would you give as a final year, clinical trainee, going on into, your future career? We have students who listen into our podcast, we have practitioners, early career researchers, things like that. So what would be your kind of top tip for them?
I think my top tip would probably be something around really just enjoying the journey, because it's a really long road and it can be difficult and frustrating at times. But I think it gave me so much job experience and work experience in so many different fields, and that experience was so invaluable and I'm so grateful for it. So I think it's just really important to enjoy the journey, but also find yourself in spaces that feel positive and nourishing and where you're able to learn and grow as a clinician.
I like that. I like the words you used, positive and nourishing. I love that. Romana, you are, doing amazing things, and you're obviously in terms of your leadership position and obviously just your journey as well, because obviously you've been through it all. What are some of your top tips?
I guess for me, I often think about what's helped me kind of in my journey. And I think like that connection with individuals, that solidarity. I've had loads of like Black women who have supported and nourished and kind of empowered me. And I would really kind of encourage people to find those people, find those connections and those spaces where they feel valued and appreciated and understood, and how important it is to kind of hold on to those relationships when you do find them as well. I think that's what I'm helped me navigate and clinical psychology.
Absolutely. And I think you're both trailblazers, and I can't wait to see your work as well. I'm coming out, and I bet you're glad that you're going to be finishing soon, right? Are you glad it's going to be over?
You have no idea.
So have you got anything planned?
Just a mega holiday for off travel.
I feel you. Right, so I'm going to have to wrap up now because I'm conscious of time, and I know you've got to leave as well. Thank you so much for both of you for joining me. And I'd love to hear more about this at some point as well, just kind of see what kind of work you're doing. And I think, like I said, it's something that we've not really spoken about much in our podcast. So I'm sure there's going to be listeners out there who are really interested. And obviously, we'll take your details. Or if you've got social media and all of that kind of stuff. I know, Romana, you have, because I am obsessed with Twitter. So I think that should be my slogan: obsessed with Twitter. We'll get some information from you, pop it onto our website as well. I'm going to end this here. So thank you both so much.
Thank you, Afsana.
Thank you, Afsana.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I just want to apologise for the sound quality on my part. I don't know what happened there, but I'll try and get that fixed for next time. But, you know, as long as you can hear the stars of the show, Romana Rimma, Clinias and Clear, that's what counts, right? But yeah, I hope that you were able to take away, you know, those key messages that they spoke about, because I certainly learned so much from them in this very short time frame. As always, you know, thank you very much for listening in. We're now reaching over 7,500 listeners worldwide. So please, you know, like, subscribe, tell us what you think's going well, what we can do to improve, as always. And yeah, we'll see you next time. Until then, take care, look after yourselves. Bye-bye.